Do you know something? Last night I went to see the new Elvis movie, the new Baz Luhrmann get-together, and I was at one and the same time excited about going to see it, but I was also kind of trepidatious, if you can say such a thing. Is that a real word? Well, now it's a real word, because I've been a lifelong Elvis fan, and I was just wondering how they were going to treat the whole thing. And I know the reviews have been good, but, you know, it's not till you see it yourself and make your own mind up about it that the kind of clicks with yourself. But I'm delighted to welcome on the line a guy who's a Waterford native, a Daisha man true and true. He knows his blaz. He's working between Dublin and Maynooth in his own lifestyle and work these days. And that is Martin Clancy. Great to talk to you, Martin.
You too, Oliver. Great to chat again.
Well, now, in terms of your own credentials, you two have been pretty much a lifelong Elvis fan as well. Indeed, one time head of his fan club here in Ireland.
That's true, yeah. Massive Elvis fan. Been to Graceland 9 times now. I've toured
wow.
the house probably 20 plus times. So, yeah, huge Elvis fan. Lucky enough as well, you know, during time when I was working in broadcasting to make some documentaries on his life and speaking with some of his friends and family members. And I've gotten to meet everyone from his cousins to best men at his wedding, all the way to Priscilla, his former wife. So huge Elvis fan, and just delighted to be talking to you about this movie because there was such anticipation about it. I remember even in 2019, the last time I was in Graceland, which being pre-COVID, Priscilla mentioned that this was upcoming because it was kind of a fan get-together and she was talking at it. And she made a joke saying that the estate had nothing to actually do with the film itself, but if it turned out to be a success, she'd make sure that they were all over it. And I think that is exactly what happened in the end.
Yeah, well, there you have it. Do you know what we'll do? We'll take a little listen to the trailer, first off, kind of set the scene of where we're going on all of this here.
Well, since my baby left me...
Mom, am I going to put me in jail?
The way you sing is God-given. So there can't be nothing wrong with it.
Well, it's one for my money.
If you don't listen to me,
you will fall the show.
All that your mama has sacrificed for you will be for nothing. Trust me.
Do you hear me ready now? Go, can go.
There's been a lot of talk about the new Elvis.
Without me, there would be no Elvis Presley.
Reverend once told me that things are too dangerous to say. Sing.
Ladies and gentlemen, here's Elvis Presley.
This ain't no nostalgia show. We're going to do something different.
And just to echo the last line of that, it certainly wasn't no nostalgia show, and they certainly did something different. Baz Luhrmann's treatment of it. You know, Martin, when I was going to it, I thought to myself, I just hope this isn't too much over the top. You know, the way he does these lavish productions and the story's kind of forgotten in it. But I have to say, he was very clever in so many aspects of it. You have Colonel Tom Parker narrating it. Now, who would have thought to do that in the first place?
A brilliant idea. Like, to tell Elvis the story, I suppose, through the Colonel's eyes was a brilliant idea from Baz's. And it just gives the story a lot of context. It gives you as well that kind of villain figure in it. I'm not sure if it's totally fair to the Colonel, to be honest. I'm certainly not a defender of Colonels, but even Elvis's friends and Priscilla, like, all of them will say that they had a lot of respect for the Colonel and for what he did. But ultimately, I think the best way to describe Colonel Parker is he was a promoter, not a manager. So he didn't know how to manage an artistic talent like Elvis Presley, but he knew how to promote Elvis Presley. And certainly at the start of the career, he really helped catapult him. But to go back to like what you're talking about, Baz has done such a tremendous job at it. At the start, it's like this cinematic feast. There's just so much going on, so much colour, vibrancy. And then as the film starts to evolve, it settles down a little bit. And I thought that the role that Austin Butler played, because I didn't know much about him until he had taken
Same
up the
here,
role.
Same here, Martin, yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of concerned as to, like, will he be able to nail Elvis? Will he be able to portray him properly, because I think people have tried in the past, maybe not quite hit the mark, because it's very large shoes to step into, but he does such a great job, like such a great job. And I think as the film progresses, he becomes even more confident as Elvis, and even more convincing for me as Elvis, especially when you get towards Elvis's return to Vegas in 69, 70, when they're recreating some of those scenes from the International Hotel. At times you're wondering whether it's Elvis or it's Austin Butler up on stage when you're watching the show. And the attention to detail is something, like, as a huge Elvis fan watching the movie, if there wasn't attention to detail, things would annoy me. But, like, everything from not just costumes to, like, they rebuilt Graceland.
They rebuilt Graceland in Australia, can we say?
In Australia, yeah. And the attention to detail inside it, like, to the point where Elvis bought Graceland in the 50s, and for each segment of the film, as the film moved into the 60s or the 70s, they updated the modelling and interior decoration of Graceland as Elvis did during those time periods. So at the start of the film, when Elvis was first in Graceland, there's aspects of the house that are not there, that by the end of the film, which Elvis would have added at later times, you see in the decor of the house. From seeing interviews with Baz Luhrmann, he's talked about the years of research that he put into this. Everything from, like, the stage suits, that they're all on par. They're not kind of tacky, cheap imitations of Elvis's stage suits. Like, they're on par with exactly what Bill Ballew, Elvis's costume designer, was creating for him at the time. They just seem to have gotten everything spot on. The showroom in Vegas, they've recreated the way it was when it opened in 69 and 70. That showroom is still there today. Barry Manilow is playing it.
Wow.
Yeah, Manilow's the headliner there.
That's the International Hotel as it was then.
It was then. It was the International originally when Elvis signed up in 69. In 72, it became the Las Vegas Hilton. Elvis played there until 76. And it remained the Hilton until, I think, like, the early 2000s, when it became the LVH. And now it's the Westgate in Las Vegas.
Mm.
But they still have the original showroom, original stage. The only change they've really made in there is they've removed the dining tables and the booths and replaced it with, like, stadium-style seating, as you get in any showroom now.
Pack him in, exactly.
Yeah.
Do you know something, Martin? When Austin Butler was tipped for the part, and a whole load of people had auditioned for this, including Harry Styles auditioned for this, but I have to say, I was a little trepidatious about the fact that he didn't look a whole lot like him, you know? And of course, you're talking about somebody who was probably the best looking man on the planet ever. So it was going to be hard to get anybody to look like him, act like him, and all the rest of it. But I have to say, he really, at times there in the movie, whatever way the angle he would take or look, he was very convincing in that, wasn't he?
Exceptionally so. Like, exceptionally so. And I thought especially more so towards the end of the film, or the middle to the end.
The 68 special, certainly on.
My God, he absolutely did a tremendous job with the 68 special. That's Elvis in the black leather suit. And seeing interviews with him, he mentioned that they were the first scenes they filmed. And he said the absolute fear that he felt trying to walk on stage, because they filmed those kind of as live. He had to get up and try and perform as Elvis in those sequences. And he did such a tremendous job. I found him very convincing. I found him very authentic as well. I know that Priscilla loved it from seeing interviews with her. Lisa Marie loved it as well. And both of them said they feel very protective of Austin Butler now.
Yeah.
He's done such a great job.
And they ought to know, the fella says. But also Tom Hanks as Colonel Tom. I thought he did an excellent, excellent portrayal of him.
So did I. And, you know, to begin with, when I saw the first trailers and I heard the accent, I was like, I'm not sure about this. Yeah. But it does. It just works so well. People who have not seen the movie won't know this reference, but, like, the snowman, which is something that Colonel Parker was big into. He had the Snowman's League of America, basically a way of saying that you would bluff and bluster at people and get what you wanted. And I think Tom Hanks kind of really embraced that type of character and that portrayal of the Colonel. Yeah, it was done so well.
Wasn't it just? And when we first see Tom Hanks as Colonel Tom, he's kind of this carnival huckster that spots this talent. And there's a scene in it there where, again, if you're not an Elvis fan, you won't 100% understand it, but he had these tap-dancing chickens for all the world.
Yeah.
And how he did that was they were literally standing on hot plates. So the poor old chickens were literally lifting their feet to avoid the heat of these hot plates while some carnival music was playing in the background. That's where he was coming from. Anywhere he could make a fast buck, he was on it.
Totally, yeah. And what's most interesting as well is, and they do this quite well in the movie, when Colonel first sees Elvis performing, in the early 50s, it's not so much Elvis that he's looking at, it's the reaction of the fans, it's the reaction of the women in the audience, the reaction of the men in the audience, and the reaction of, like, the older generation in the audience as well.
He was so different to anything that was there before. You're talking about the Perry Comos, the Frank Sinatras, the Andy Williamses, all these great, great performers, but nothing like what was just about to happen and explode.
Absolutely, yeah. They do a really good portrayal of how dangerous conservative America felt Elvis Presley was going to be.
Oh, big time.
Which is incredible, because if anything, by the end of Elvis's life, he was kind of part of American culture and society. Like, Jimmy Carter gave a presidential address the day Elvis died saying that he'd left an indelible mark on 20th century popular culture and American popular culture.
Gosh, how things had changed over the years, no doubt about it.
Amazing.
Yeah. Incredible.
The very end of the film, a bit that now, from my perspective, I was choking up in the cinema.
Oh, same here, Martin. Yeah, for anybody who's a true Elvis fan.
Yeah,
and we're not giving anything away here by saying that he's on stage, it's his last concert performance, and whatever people say about him or don't say about him, he never lost his voice. Never lost his voice. Just incredible to think, really.
There to the end. They do a great piece in it where they transition between the film and actual footage of Elvis at that point.
Again, very clever, Martin.
Very clever. And heartbreaking to see the toll. Mm. And Elvis, I suppose, ultimately Elvis's inability to cope with the superstardom as well, but he had no blueprint, he had no point of reference as to how you cope with this stress.
Absolutely, But also the box that he was in, that Colonel Tom had him in, tied up contractually. He wanted to tour the world and was all excited about that, you know, and was on the verge of contracts for that kind of thing. But the Colonel just brought him into many other things. And that was like the likes of the Aloha from Hawaii was another kind of... And, you know, I never saw it and thought of it that way before, as a kind of an appeaser, and not to be traveling around. Why do you have to travel around the world when we can do this via satellite?
Yeah, that's it. The Aloha special came about because Colonel was an illegal alien and couldn't get himself out of the United States because he had no passport to go with Elvis on tour. And he came up with the idea of the Aloha special from watching one of the, I think it was one of the Frazier Alley fights that was syndicast across America to auditoriums at once. So I know Elvis went to see it in Ellis Auditorium in downtown Memphis, and it could be 71, don't hold me to the date, but I think it was 71.
Mm.
And Colonel got the idea off the back of that if technology could come on just a little bit more, he could put Elvis in one place and have everyone watch Elvis from their living room. Elvis wouldn't have to travel, and everyone could see him.
He was crafty, he was clever.
Yeah. And did the same with Vegas, like put Elvis in one spot and get everyone to come to see him, instead of making him go to see them.
Yeah, but also the point where he was almost had Elvis to the point, and he was to the point of paranoia in terms of his own safety. You know, the fact security was going to be such a huge thing abroad, which of course it wouldn't have been, you know, any more than any other superstar that was traveling at the time. But he just, again, used this as a way now of making sure this guy doesn't move out of the box, even down to the likes of, A Star is Born, which was the remake of that with Barbara Streisand, and Chris Christopherson.
Yeah.
And she went backstage to him. Now, it's only mentioned in the movie, but she went backstage to him at one of his performances, and he was mad to do the part of Bradley Cooper.
Yes,
that's the part he would have been playing, And he was mad to do it. But again, the Colonel just stymied it all, and just because, you know, the billing was a thing, it might have been a whole new kickstart to him.
Yeah, and I think, Colonel was very paranoid about basically losing Elvis. So as you'll discover in the film, Colonel was a degenerate gambler who had huge debts from his gambling, and had gambled away most of the money that he'd made from his partnerships with Elvis.
50%, can we say?
Yeah, exactly. He needed the income from Elvis. So, when the Streisand film came up, I think it was more to do with Colonel being fearful of Elvis being exposed to the likes of Barbara Streisand, her management team, and different ways of thinking. You see it even in the 68 comeback in the film.
Oh, I think that's a great way of looking at it, yeah.
He's very nervous about Elvis being exposed to other people and other thoughts. It kind of envelops him and takes over what way he reacts towards Elvis. And certainly, I think for the world tours towards the end, he was able to scare Elvis around the security details. Elvis at that point had a prescription drug habit, which he used. They don't press on it too much in the film, but Colonel used to kind of remind Elvis that he wouldn't have access to his medical care, as he put it, if he was abroad. as he would in the United States. So it was all control. It was just a very controlling personality.
Which stymied him in so many ways, because there were so many things, like even being signed into those 33 movies, incidentally, all of which made money. Not too many actors can say that. Still continue to make money, but in no way brought him any kind of, you know, outside of maybe the likes of Jailhouse Rock, perhaps, or King Creole.
Yeah,
outside of that, he was just the same old vehicle in a different name and a different town and all the rest of it. And he really felt let down at that because he had such aspirations. You know, he was a huge, hugely influenced by the likes of James Dean and Tony Curtis. In fact, Tony Curtis, I think, was the reason he dyed his hair black, because he was quite kind of fair.
That's correct,
Initially,
And one of the things that used to irk him as well was, so Hal Wallace was the big producer for Paramount in the early 60s, and Elvis was making those films such as G.I. Blues and Blue Hawaii.
Conveyor Belt.
Box office. Yeah, massive hits. Profits from those Paramount were using to make iconic movies that would stand the test of time.
Right.
And that started to annoy him, because he wanted to be taken as a serious actor, and he wanted those roles. What they discovered was, when they put him into any kind of serious role, it wouldn't be the box office success that a Blue Hawaii or a G.I. Blues would be. So Colonel's argument always was, we'll get a movie, we'll get a soundtrack. He was the first actor to be paid $1 million for making a movie. Colonel was kind of like, what's your argument?
Yeah.
But greenbacks. Yeah, we know from, like, and I think because artists and the music industry and people, I think emotionally are much more intelligent emotionally now, probably. Intelligent might be the wrong word, but much more free in talking about their emotions.
Yeah.
That he was artistically suffocating inside this poor quality material. He was an exceptionally creative individual.
Do you know what? When you look at the likes of the 68 comeback and how he was responsible for so much of that, once the producers were working with them, but in terms of how things were done, how things would sound, he was very in there. Like in the Vegas years, you know, when he had the Joe Gershaw Orchestra and how he wanted things done there, he was hands-on, creative out.
Yes, yeah, and like he choreographed. Not only did he choreograph himself for that iconic scene in Jailhouse Rock that everyone will, if anyone sees that, they'll probably remember, but for his Vegas shows, he choreographed the backing singers, he choreographed and produced the music with Glenn D. Hardin and with Joe Gershaw. Like, he knew what he wanted from a sound perspective, from an onstage perspective, an appearance perspective. So he was very good at bringing all those pieces together.
Do you know, it's hard to believe up to that 68 special, he hadn't performed live for 10 years.
Exactly, and Priscilla's given interviews, because she met Elvis, obviously, when he was in the army, which would have been 58, 59, and he wasn't performing, and then as their relationship developed in the 60s, the first time she saw him on stage was the 68 comeback special.
Was it?
And yeah. And,
I never knew
and
that.
She said, after the show, she said, during the show, she sat there and she said, afterwards, after the show, she thought to herself, I get it. Because she didn't get it before, as to, she'd heard how great he was, but had never witnessed it. And she said, after the show, she just sat there and was like, I now get it. I get what this love affair between Elvis and his fans is. I get how much energy he expands from the stage. And I get how electrifying the whole experience is.
Because
all she would have seen was read about it, or seen TV clips, maybe.
Gosh, I never realized that, Martin. Also, the part that his mother played in his life, he was devoted to his mam. She was a huge influence on him and obviously loved him dearly, as indeed did Vernon, his dad, but it was a different relationship, and he had lost his twin brother, Jesse, was lost at birth, so she was very protective of him, never trusted the Colonel one inch.
No. She was exceptionally protective of him, and their relationship was really, really close, because his father ended up in jail for a period for forging a check to feed the family because they were so poor.
And that was literally it. He wasn't a crook. He wasn't a bad man by any stretch of the imagination, but he was just in desperate times which required desperate measures.
That's it, yeah. And he went to jail with one of Gladys, that's Elvis's mother, one of Gladys's brothers. Both of them forged the check, and they were going to split the proceeds to try and feed the family or their families. But the relationship between Elvis and Gladys, like, I'm certain, had Gladys lived, Elvis certainly would have lived an awful lot longer.
Oh, I'd agree. Things would have been different.
Yeah, he seemed to lose direction a little bit after she died. He was also, like, he was training to go into the army in Texas, when she died, got leave to go back to Memphis, and then shortly afterward had to go to Germany. But it was such a huge hit to him, losing his mother, and because of how close their relationship was. But also, he didn't know whether he would have a career when he came back from Germany or not, because everyone was saying rock and roll was a flash in the pan. This guy would be forgotten about.
And that's the thing people forget, too. He didn't know when this was going to end.
No. I think, like, in Elvis's life, the only certainty of his longevity possibly came, unfortunately, towards the end. He did make comments towards the end saying that he didn't think he'd be remembered for anything, that he hadn't done anything significant or lasting, and how wrong he was. But I think, like, certainly in the 50s, he was terrified it was a flash in the pan. In the 60s, he was terrified that no one really would remember him for these movies. You'll see a scene in the film where he asks Steve Binder as to where he thinks his career is at, and the response is in the toilet. That did happen. Yeah. He liked the honesty.
Can I ask you, did that happen on location in Hollywood, at the Hollywood sign, or was that...
No, it happened on location in Burbank in California, which is where NBC filmed...
I was wondering, yeah.
The actual... Actually, what did happen was Steve Binder brought Elvis out onto the lot, and Elvis was a bit hesitant to walk out onto the lot, onto the street, the public side of it, because he felt he'd get mobbed, but... Three or four people walked past and didn't take any notice of him. And that's when he asked him, where does he think his career was at? Because there seemed to be a slight realization, even though he was iconic at that point.
Yeah.
And may have just been unlucky with the people who walked past.
Yeah.
That something was going amiss at that point.
In terms of the Memphis Mafia, as they were referred to, Jerry Schilling's the only one that seems to come out with any kind of real interest in him for his own good, let's say. Because they never came off the payroll at any point, and they really relied on him. He literally was their meal ticket.
He was. Jerry's in it. I think Jerry's kind of the only real Memphis Mafia member that's portrayed in the movie. They do make reference to a few others, but it's Jerry that's portrayed mostly. I've met an awful lot of the Memphis Mafia. None of them has changed over time. Charlie, Larry Geller, Sonny West, Red West, Billy Smith would be
Billy Smith, yeah. And there's Billy a slight Smith. Reference to him where he's as a kid in the film. Like, there was about 10 years or a little more between them. And, he was Gladys's brother's son, so Elvis's cousin.
And Billy's still alive. He's living in Mississippi at the moment. Ultimately, what I'd say about the Memphis Mafia is Elvis chose to keep them around.
He did.
Always. And he felt a security with them. It was his choice to have them there. They knew him probably better than a lot of people, including a lot of, like, girlfriends or transient figures in his life who had brief glimpses of him.
Well, they were literally living with him those years. And when you look at Graceland, Graceland's a beautiful place. Now, I've never been, and I'd love to go at some stage, but it's not the manor house that you'd know in Ireland. It's not, a Rossborough house or anything like that. It's a big place, but nothing to the extent of that. So you had family living there. You had the Memphis Mafia living there. Yeah, I'd say it was claustrophobic enough at times. Because they were inviting their girlfriends in and friends and all the rest of it.
And that's one of the complaints from Priscilla, was like that they couldn't get any privacy.
And I could understand that.
Yeah. The only space that they had privacy, or Elvis ever really had privacy, is upstairs at Graceland, which to an extent he still does today, because that's closed for tours.
Yeah.
For various reasons, he passed away up there, but they'd also have to architecturally change the house for fire regulations if they wanted to bring tours up.
Right.
But I think out of respect, it's best...
Oh, I think
not
so.
Not have people go up there to see where he passed. It's a magical place, what I would say, Graceland. There's a great...
I was just going to ask, what did you think of it, especially on your first outing there?
My first outing there, kid in a candy shop, like it's a gleaming house on the top of a hill. Do you know, beautiful columns, Georgian columns going into it. Those magic gates as they open up that Elvis had installed with music notes and his own image on them.
The wall that Bruce Springsteen got over at one stage there and ran up to the door, hammered on the door during a gig he was doing in Memphis many years ago.
It's incredible. And you walk around the house and exactly as you said, like, you're kind of like, it's not as big as you think it would be, but what you start to realize quite quickly is it was a home, like, and still feels like a home.
Right.
And you can nearly see Elvis walking around some of the rooms. It's gotten a lot bigger. What I mean by that is, like, across the street, they're after opening several museums now. They have Presley Motors, where they have all of the cars that he had at different periods in his life. They have then a separate area with all of his stage costumes from the 70s. And they've really expanded the entire experience. They have, I think they call it Vernon's Barbecue Bakehouse. Like, they've nameplates now on restaurants and the likes that they have. As added attractions.
It's a huge industry.
Huge. And it's amazing when you think, like, 45 years in August, Elvis is gone. He lived for 42 years, and he was famous for 21 of those 42 years while alive.
Yeah, yeah.
He's left like an indelible impact.
Absolutely.
On the world. And it does make you think, after watching this movie, what else could have been done had he not been kind of held back artistically, and ultimately if he'd lived.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what? Just addressing the whole amphetamines and uppers and downers kind of issue thing, and you see early on at the start where they were all kind of taking pills, you know, the likes of the Johnny Cashes, the Carl Sperkins people.
Yeah.
Like they were going gig to gig, and they were, people forget how big the States is. They were literally driving through the night after the gig to get to where they were going for the following day. So they reckoned that you needed something to keep your eyelids, literally your eyelids open, to get there in one piece, because they weren't flying anywhere that time, you know, and or if you were, it was very expensive to do so. And look what happened to Buddy Holly, let's say.
Exactly.
But that was the start of it. But he had an unshakable belief in vitamin pills. Pills that basically, as I said, were uppers and downers, and didn't really see any great wrong in that. Like, he wasn't doing heroin, he wasn't doing cocaine, he wasn't doing hard drugs, let's just say, but he was hooked on amphetamines.
He was, yeah, and that kind of whole cycle then that starts to emerge after years of essentially abusing them, which was he would take an upper to stay awake, then he would have to take a downer or a sleeping tablet to get to sleep, and he was a famous insomniac even without the uppers added into the equation. And then he'd wake up groggy and would take a painkiller after a while to try and quell the grogginess. Then another upper to get on stage. And as the years wound on, it started to take a huge impact physically on him. And I think, like, started in the 50s, he was also given amphetamines, famously, and speed by the US Army, as all GIs were, in the late 50s to keep them awake on maneuvers.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then the 60s, he continued to use them. And by the 70s, as he went back to live performing, I mean, at one point in Vegas, Elvis was doing a 6 p.m., 9 p.m., and midnight show.
I was so glad you made that point, because, again, unless you're an Elvis fan, you don't know that. You think he was just out on stage once a day, let's say, or now and again. But you look at the likes of Ed Sheeran, he's doing a three-year tour at the minute, but it's all weekend work. You know, he's not working state to state, city to city. There was, you know, they make reference to the 15-night tour, 15 cities, 15 separate concerts. But in the Vegas residency thing, yeah, imagine doing two and three shows in a 24-hour period when you're an artist of his caliber.
It was insane, absolutely insane.
But again, the Colonel, I think, had so much to answer for there.
Oh, he did, yeah. And he should never have tied Elvis into that type of a grueling contract. And the monotony of it as well, doing the same set list three times in one night.
And giving your all.
For that, yeah. And then trying to come down off it. And Elvis also, like, in the 70s, would do six nights a week on that stage in that hotel for a month. So he'd get one day that he wouldn't be performing. Then stay on for 2 weeks after each engagement to kind of unwind and relax, which is understandable after working that hard. But there's a monotony then that starts to play into it. And I think they made a great reference in the movie. They called it the Gilded Cage or the Golden Cage that you have me in here. And that's what it was. It was paying exceptionally well. Like, he was the best paid performer in Las Vegas. That was part of the deal the Colonel struck. Actually, in the movie, the Colonel strikes the deal for Elvis to be the best paid performer in Vegas. And then famously, and this happened as well, turned around at the hotel and said, "Now that's for my boy. What do you want to pay me?"
Yeah. could only be. There's so many aspects of it. You have the frightening scene there, which was true, where they literally had his head in an ice bucket. And the Colonel saying, "I don't care what you have to do to get that man on that stage in the next, whatever it was, hour or so." It just showed the ruthlessness of it.
Completely. That scene, like, they have it in Vegas, but it actually took place in Lexington, Kentucky in 76. And Elvis was in a hotel room where it was Dr. Nick was trying to revive him. And Colonel did come out of the room and say, "The only thing that matters is that man is on stage tonight."
Yeah.
And Colonel explained later that his issue was that Elvis was not fulfilling his contractual was not fulfilling his contracts, for the touring, and was saying he was sick at times, and Colonel had just had enough of it, because from Colonel's perspective, he didn't really understand the fact that Elvis was hooked on these pills, and this is what was causing the problem. And
a very ill man. He had awful colon problems, which he inherited pretty much from his mam. But, yeah. You know, there was a stage there where he literally, just to put it very bluntly, he hadn't gone to the toilet in something like 5 or 6 months.
Yeah, like Elvis had like loads of health issues, which a lot of them were brought on from the drug abuse. Because you'll read that if people are abusing painkillers, if they're abusing sleeping medication, it has knock-on effects on digestive systems and any kind of pre-existing conditions or genetically conditions people may be susceptible to. It just heightens and worsens the effect of them.
You're just not functioning properly.
Not functioning at all. And it's so sad because like he was like not just stunning, but so creative, so artistic, so talented.
And a really good guy at the back of it all in terms of, yeah, who came from real poverty. Yeah. And knew what it was not to have and was very giving in his own life. Just to make a few quick points, he was the first major artist to credit black musicians on his albums. And that was a huge thing. That was a major thing. And that was a big risk for him to be taken.
Yeah. And there's a lot of unfair criticism about Elvis appropriating black music.
Oh, it's just ridiculous stuff.
Which, again, is resurfacing now. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the stuff has to be viewed in context of the time. And for context of the time, or even now, Elvis was exceptionally liberal, had loads of friends of all different races.
You see images there of Big Mama Thornton in the movie there, Hound Dog came from, and his influence on that, and the likes of Fats Domino, who we introduced as the real king of rock and roll. This is the guy, you know, and many other people besides. You know, B.B. King also in there. And I remember seeing B.B. King being interviewed, and he just said, what he thought of Elvis, he just said, I love that man.
Yeah. And like, Sammy Davis was a very good friend of Elvis's as well.
He opened doors for lots of people himself, Jackson, even though he was stuck.
Yeah.
I think was a good way to put it. Just to sum up the movie.
To sum it up, so I approached it probably being overly critical, I think, before I went in, hoping it would be something that would really wow me.
I tell you what was in my head was the Kurt Russell movie all those years ago. Do you remember that one?
Yes. Yeah. 79.
Yeah. And again, he did a good job for what he was allowed to do on it at the time. But this is another step.
Yeah. Like I went in kind of worried that it wouldn't hit the mark. And I have to say, ran the whole gauntlet of emotions during the nearly
totally.
3 hours that it runs.
I did not feel the time. Can I say that?
No. I totally agree with you. And everything from like joy to sadness to frustration to happiness to the ending. But I have to say, like, they've knocked it out of the ballpark. I think Austin Butler has done such a service to Elvis in this and the way he's portrayed him. It's so authentic.
There's only so much you can do within a 3-hour parameter, you know, in terms of such a big story and such a multifaceted story.
That's it. And I see some people online saying that, you know, they don't want to see it because he doesn't look exactly like Elvis. Well, I think it's going to be hard to find an exact Elvis replica to play Elvis.
Yeah.
There's some criticism that maybe some parts of it, they're a bit loose with the truth as to what may or may not have happened or when something did or didn't happen in it. I mean, you're trying to squeeze 21 years or 42 years essentially of someone's life into 3 hours. You have to take a little bit of artistic license to get some main points over the line quickly.
And old Linda Thompson felt a little hard done by there.
She did, yes. Linda was Elvis's long-term girlfriend after his marriage to Priscilla ended, so from 72 to 76. But Ginger Alden, who was his girlfriend from late 76 until he died, and who found him after he passed away, he was engaged to Ginger. But like, they're not portrayed in the movie. But all I would say to that, and I can totally understand where they're coming from and the hurt and maybe frustration, is the prism this movie is presented in is it's Colonel Parker talking about his life with Elvis and how he witnessed the different aspects. Well, the movie is, yes, about Elvis. I can see how they may have decided that, like, not all of Elvis' personal life, and just, like, not all of the Memphis Mafia, like, his wedding isn't really covered that much in it either to Priscilla. So there's parts, for the most part, they ignore all of the movies in the 60s. They might spend 10 or 15 minutes on it, but it's a period that's brushed over quite quickly. Like, they moved to the 68 comeback quite quickly compared to how fast, let's say, they moved from Elvis signing from Sun to RCA to going to the Army. But look, a visual feast, I'd encourage everyone to go see it on the big screen. It's like being back in Vegas during that time period at times to see him up there.
Even if you're not an Elvis fan, can I say it's a very interesting story, but be prepared to be an Elvis fan.
Coming out.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah.
And great to think a whole new generation is getting a better look at him, Martin, isn't it?
That's it. It's fabulous. And I think, you know, the soundtrack came out there on Spotify, I think it was Saturday last week. Fabulous. Like, there's remixes of some of his tracks with contemporary artists. Eminem is on it. The King and I is the name of the song he has on that soundtrack. And it's bringing him, as you said, to a whole new audience, a whole new generation. It's retelling the story. And I think Priscilla put it up the best way on Twitter or Facebook last week. She just said he's back, and that's after the movie finished at number one last weekend in the US box office. It overtook Top Gun.
Wow. And that says a lot.
It does, because that, by all accounts, is a tremendous film as well.
Yes, indeed, and pumped to the last, and a lot of people endeared with the original Top Gun and, you know, the connection that is there. But as I say, those closing the closing footage in the movie, I thought was very emotional. Brought a tear to my eye now, I have to say. And it's funny. No other performer, I have to say, has touched me as much in my life. You'd almost, to an extent, consider family and be protective of, I'd have to say.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's great to hear you say that, because that's the way I feel as well.
Yeah.
It's amazing how many people feel that about him.
Yeah.
He seems to have like crossed over some sort of line with people emotionally, and maybe
that's just
longevity.
You think of it, Martin. You weren't even born.
No.
Well, you know, when he died. I was, but I was only about 6 years of age when that happened. But I can remember it vividly.
Yeah.
And I can remember, I can tell you that my first two singles I ever bought, Dave Edmunds' Girls Talk, on the same day I bought, and it was a reissue in 1978, of Hound Dog with Don't Be Cruel on the B-side.
God.
And I was sold. And I played it, and I played it, and I played it, and I played it till the wax wore off.
Wore out, yeah. It's the raw emotion in it.
Isn't it?
The early stuff. He's powerful. Like, his gospel music, he's just very... You kind of feel he sings with soul and meaning in a lot of those records. Yeah, and that footage at the end is the piece that's just hard to watch, but you kind of have to watch it to understand the toll it took.
Yeah, something like special.
I heard the story about how that footage came from a special called the CBS Special, which was filmed on Elvis's last tour, and it aired after he died. And Colonel did the deal with CBS, and a lot of people said to him afterwards, why did you ever let them film him when he looked like that?
Yeah.
And a lot of them felt had he lived, he would have just refused to allow it to go out and would have gotten himself in better shape.
Which was probably the case.
Tour, to do a better stab at it. And it may have leaked out eventually on the bootleg market, but he would try to avoid it getting out. Anyway, long story short, Colonel said that he gave CBS a ridiculous number for how much money he wanted for it, and they agreed. So he said, he just said to Elvis, they've offered this. Do you want to take it? Talking to, like, even some of the Memphis Mafia, and I think it was Jerry Schilling who actually said it, that Colonel never really knew what Elvis was worth and was constantly astounded that when he threw out what he thought was a ridiculous figure, that people were agreeing, to the point where he'd come off the phone after doing a deal thinking that maybe he'd been shortchanged. The next time he'd do a deal, he'd go higher again.
Well, indeed.
He always felt there needed to be a fight.
For someone who knew his tap dancing chickens. My God almighty.
It's too easy.
It is a tour de force, and even at the start of it there, the breakdown of the movie, the split screens, harking back to the Elvis on Tour movie, I thought was extremely clever as well. I just thought it was extremely well thought out, so well put together, and told an incredible story with a lot to chew on there, let's just say.
1,000%, and on the Elvis on Tour, kind of what you mentioned there, the fact that it was paying homage to that, that was filmed by Warner Brothers, who've released this movie as well. Mm. And Baz Luhrmann has said that depending on the success of this movie, he'd be interested in re-editing that concert documentary, which is 80 hours of footage of Elvis on stage and off stage, into something far
more impressive,
contemporary audiences and a streaming service. So fingers crossed that could be the next big re-release of an Elvis on Tour production.
Remember where you heard it first, is all I'll say, here on The Spin Home in the good company of myself and Martin Clancy. So now, Martin, it has been a pleasure talking to you. I'm so glad I got the opportunity to talk to you. And
I
really do appreciate you taking the time on this today. But I thought an important one, you know.
Totally. And you too. Thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoy that.
Great to hear you. Thanks so much, Martin.